Oh, sure. Well, so my name is David McCallum. I'm an extremely humble person. I like to think that I am humble to the point where I get along with people, and I'm a people's person, and I like to have dialogue, particularly dialogue that's very important to the overall conversation of our society. And, I think that works for me, and I'm going to continue to do the same exact things that I've promised myself that I would do, prior to my exoneration. So here I am.
Hi, this is Brooke. Thanks for joining me for episode 22 of Actual Innocence. 22. I can't believe it's been that many episodes. Before we get started, I have a couple of announcements. There's still time to sign up for the listener meetups. You just need to go to actualinpod.com, click on support, and then events. The events are totally free, but we need you to register to make sure we have enough space. Also, Actual Innocence is looking for a couple of volunteers. One who would be able to manage a section of the website, and others who might be able to do some transcripts of the episodes. I've gotten several requests from family members of those who are currently incarcerated for transcripts to send to their innocent loved ones. If you think that you would be available to do either one of these jobs, please email me and I'll send you a little more information. Actual Innocence is a podcast that tells the stories of people who served time for crimes they did not commit. Listen to the heartbreaking true accounts of wrongfully convicted people and their journey to exoneration. Thanks so much for listening. And now we're going to talk about one of our most relevant sponsors before we get on to the episode. A new crime drama has come to ABC on Monday nights this fall. It's called Conviction, and it looks at the American justice system in a very unique way. Each year, over 10,000 people in America are wrongly convicted. They could be victims of mistaken identities, forensic errors, mishandled or tampered evidence, police corruption, and more. Inspired by real-life conviction integrity units that have been formed across the country, this team's purpose is to investigate potential wrongful convictions. The investigation team on Conviction doesn't put people in prison. Their job is to help free the wrongly convicted, kind of like ours. The team only has 5 days per case to investigate. Then they can recommend that a conviction be overturned or not. Just 5 days to uncover the truth. The show stars Haley Atwell of Marvel's Agent Carter as the leader of the unit, a former president's daughter, Hayes Morrison. She has a brilliant legal mind, but also has her own troubles with the law that make her perfectly suited for this job of providing second chances for the potentially wrongfully incarcerated. There are a lot of twists and turns in this fast-paced criminal series, with stories torn from today's headlines. The CIU won't always overturn a conviction. They might even free someone who is really guilty, but they will always work together to reveal the truth. You'll have to stay to the very end of every episode to see what's determined and if justice will be served. From the executive producer of Criminal Minds, Conviction started October 3rd after Dancing with the Stars. I can't tell you how much I love this show, and I hope that you're watching it too. David McCallum was only 16 years old when he was convicted of murder, and then sentenced to 25 years to life for a crime he did not commit. I continue to struggle to understand how our criminal justice system can steal the lives of our children. I'm Brooke, and this is David's story. So I was wondering if you could start way back at the beginning and tell me what your life was like in 1985.
Wow. Okay. So before 1985, first of all, I was born in the South. I was born in South Carolina. I came to New York when I was about 6 months old or so.
Your accent doesn't sound very South Carolina.
It doesn't because I've been Brooklynized, if that makes any sense. And so, yeah, so my family moved to Brooklyn, New York, and I moved to a place called Bedford-Stuyvesant initially. And after Bedford Stuyvesant and our family, I moved to Bushwick. And that's where I pretty much made my mark, so to speak. I went to public school there. I went to junior high school, and I actually went to high school prior to my arrest. And I like to say I have three brothers and three sisters. I have a fairly large family. I grew up in a two-parent home. It wasn't always the best of circumstances. I mean, you consider the area where I grew up at, it was not, you know, the best of circumstances in terms of in comparison to how it is now with gentrification, that sort of thing. And, you know, as far as the neighborhoods being reshaped and remodeled, I think for the better, which is a really, really good thing. But back then, things were really not that great. So for me, I like to think I came from a pretty much a middle-class family, so to speak. And, you know, I was a really good student. Could have been much better had I been paying closer attention to my schooling. But as a young teenager, I was distracted by a lot of different things, particularly friends, or like in these, now I would say so-called friends. And, you know, I started, you know, sort of missing school and that sort of thing. And my grades sort of slipped off. And, you know, that's how it was with me for the most part.
Can you tell me about the crime that you were accused of during that year?
Sure. So in 1985, particularly October 27th, 1985, myself and my co-accused, Willie Stuckey, who were both 16 years old, was arrested and charged with the murder of a gentleman from Queens named Nathan Brenner. According to police reports, Nathan Brenner was abducted in front of his home while sitting in his car. As a result, later on, two individuals walked up to Nathan Brenner and put a gun to him and demanded that he get inside the car. And all the individuals jumped in the car and drove. Later that day, I should say the very next day, Nathan Brenner's body was found in a park called Aberdeen. It's in the Bushwick section of Brooklyn. In fact, three or four blocks from my home, as a matter of fact. And as a result, there was an investigation. There was stuff going on where the officers from the 83rd precinct where I was arrested at was looking for who may have committed this crime. On October 27, 1985, about 7:30, Willie Stuckey was arrested for the crime. The reason why Willie Stuckey was arrested for the crime, because there are individuals in my community who later learned to be informants, said that they knew Willie Stuckey. He was around the neighborhood talking about some murder that took place. And as a result, he was apprehended and eventually arrested for the crime. In the precinct, this is, of course, what I learned later on from Willie Stuckey, he denied his participation in the crime several times. And as a result, he was slapped and beaten by the officers and made to make a false confession. In that false confession, Mr. Stuckey implicated me as the person who shot Nathan Brenner.
And how old were you at the time?
We were both 16 years old. So I was arrested about 3 hours later, about 10:30, 10:25 that night. I was brought down to the precinct, and I was asked, did I know anything about a person getting killed in a park the week before, which would be October 20th? When I asked him no, the police slapped me in my face. So he asked me again. He said, I'm going to ask you one more time. Did you know anything about being shot in the park? And I said no. So he raised the chair as if to hit me over the head with it. And that's when I made a confession. I made confessions implicating Willie Stuckey. So it was one of those situations where Mr. Stuckey was implicating me as the shooter, and I was implicating Mr. Stuckey as the shooter.
And how did you feel?
I felt miserable afterwards, but at the time, I was very scared. I was intimidated. In New York State, at least back then, and even to the very day, you're considered an adult at the age of 16. I wasn't treated as a juvenile, so to speak. And as a result, I didn't know anything about, I was law enforcement, because I was so scared at the time. I wasn't thinking about my Miranda warnings, Miranda rights, not that I understood them anyway, because at that particular time, I was just more concerned about what I was actually being charged with, because I know for a fact that I did not kill anyone. And I also knew at the time that Willie Stuckey didn't either, which was even more baffling to me, because I was wondering, why would Willie Stuckey confess to a crime like this? As a result, later on, I learned that Willie Stuckey was also beaten by the police and made to falsely confess. I had an alibi from when the crime was said to have been committed. I was with my sister and her friends playing handball in a park not far from my home during the time this crime was said to have been committed. But when I went to court, obviously, eventually went to trial, any time a family member testified, there's always viewed with suspicion.
No, so I just wanted to go back to, did the police ever offer you like a polygraph, or did they offer you an attorney?
No, they didn't offer me an attorney, nor did they offer me a polygraph. In fact, what happened was after the confession was made, the police called my mom. And so when they called my mom, he explained to my mom where I was and what I was being charged with. He said to my mom specifically that she can come down to court the very next morning. That's the only way she would be able to see me.
Did they appoint you an attorney, or was your family able to retain an attorney?
Well, my family wasn't able to retain an attorney, so when I went to court initially, I was assigned an 18B attorney. So that's a court-appointed attorney. And we can get into all the legal ramifications of that, which was a disaster, to say the least. But I was appointed a court-appointed attorney, Peter Murdo. Wow. So we can go into that if you want. That's like a story within a story there.
I've got time if you've got time.
Okay, I will talk. So my attorney at the time was 71 years old, and he was a gentleman who I constantly got into fights with the judge over legal issues, over late appearances in court, and that sort of thing. But at the time, I having no true or real understanding of the law or anything like that, I paid really no attention to him. But I can still remember the constant arguments that the sparring and jabs that he and the actual judge in the case would go through on a regular basis during the trial. Mr. Murdo didn't come interview me, didn't come investigate me, didn't investigate the case, didn't prepare me for court, didn't prepare me for trial, didn't come visit me at all when I was on a place called Rikers Island. He didn't do any of those things.
So you were in Rikers the whole time you were waiting for your trial?
Yes, I spent 13 months on Rikers Island all in total. So yeah, my attorney, who's now deceased. He didn't prepare me for trial. He was a lot of money through the court system for investigation purposes and stuff like that, but he never came to visit me or anything like that, so.
So he was 71 years old, and he had a bone to pick with the judge, basically.
Yes, this was it was a it was a it was a regular occurrence for him. It was not unusual for him and the judge to get into some kind of sparring match during the course of my trial. I later learned, after I was convicted and spent a lot of time upstate and doing a lot of legal research, that my attorney was later disbarred for misconduct, where he had clients, he took money from clients and stuff like that. So, when I read this information, I wasn't surprised. It's based on how he conducted himself with me and during my trial. So,
You had a co-defendant, right, Mr. Stuckey?
yes, Mr. Stuckey was my co-accused. Yes, that's correct.
Were you charged? Was it a trial together, or were they separate trials?
Oh no, we were tried together. We initially tried to get the cases severed, meaning that we tried to get the cases, which would go to trial individually. But in New York State, there's a particular law called the Cruz Law, which says that the only way you can get a case severed is if its actual prejudice is going to be shown. But because they claimed that our confessions were so identical in nature, that there would not be any prejudice thereof. So we were we ruled the ruling was made, that we should go to trial.
And so, what kind of evidence did they try to present at the trial? Because, I mean, they just have two false confessions, as far as I can tell.
Well, actually, that was the only evidence in the case, basically. I mean, they had witnesses that came to court and testified as to what they, for example, that two young children testified at trial. They didn't testify to actually see it when we stuck in an eye. They testified as to what they saw happen. Two black dudes walked up to this white guy and pulled out a gun and demanded that he get inside the car and drove off with him. That was the extent of their testimony, which we found strange because, if you see all this and you couldn't identify the individuals, we thought like, the young kids were coached into saying the things that they were testifying to. They had made previous statements to officers in that particular area who were investigating at that time the kidnapping of this individual. And during the comments that they made, they made descriptions of the people that they claimed they saw. But those descriptions were inconsistent with when he stuck in my appearance. So they, in other words, they changed their testimony once we confessed to the crime and all that sort of and that other thing.
So they made their testimony fit your appearance. That's
That's
tragic.
exactly, not necessarily our appearance, but the circumstances in which we falsely confessed to.
How long was the trial?
Well, our trial lasted about, I'm only going to say it lasted 6 days.
And was it a jury trial?
Yes, it was a jury trial, yes.
And did what did the jury look like? Did they look like you? Did they look like, were they diverse?
You know, it's kind of interesting. I don't actually exactly remember the diversity of the jury itself, but I can tell you that the forewoman was an African-American person and an African-American woman, so... that was the extent of it. I didn't know that, I don't recall anyway at this time, the makeup of the jury.
It sounds like you had, you know, a good family. Were they able to be there at the trial to support you?
Yeah, sure. I had ample support from family. And my mom, for example, was there every day supporting me. And I had my sisters and brothers there supporting me too. So I had really good support. And that was, of course, at that time, it was wonderful just to know that, just to walk into the courtroom knowing that, you know, you had your family behind you. And I can tell you that, you know, my mom, when I first got the opportunity to see my mom after I was taken to the precinct into court the very next day, they allowed me to speak to her for a couple of minutes. And she asked me a question. She asked me, David, did you do this? And I said, no, Ma, I did not. And the conversation never came up again as far as that was concerned. So that was huge for me, knowing that my mom believed me. And, you know, that was a great feeling knowing that, you know.
I've interviewed other people before, and they talked about Rikers and how terrible the situation is to be at Rikers and then to be on trial because you have to get up early and you don't get a lot of food. Like, how was that experience, like going from prison to trial?
Well, that was terrible. I mean, for me, Rikers, I mean, you have to get up early for court. They say maybe 4 o'clock in the morning for court. And you have to get lined up and you have to get ready for court. And, you know, and then you get into this holding pen in whatever building you're in on Rikers Island. And you have to wait there until the bus come. And then a boatload of inmates get on the bus and they go to court. One of the more frustrating things for me is prior to my trial, I was going back to court every month. And you go to court only for like two or three minutes. And it was so deflating to walk into the courtroom knowing that nothing was going to happen. You were going to just be ushered back to the jail, and that became hurt. It was debilitating for me. Only because I always had an expectation that something was going to happen. I always knew I was innocent of the crime, and I was just holding out hope that somehow, the truth would reveal itself every time I went to court. But of course, I was naive in terms of the legal system, and I didn't really understand what was really going on. But what was really happening when I was going to court every month was they were just sort of going through all the preliminary discussions about the case and discovery and all this kind of stuff, you know. But so nothing new. There was no expectation for them to do something with the case. So it was really defeating to have to go back to Rikers Island. And you know, Rikers Island in and of itself was such, you know, was just so depressing in that particular situation based on all the things that I was able to unfortunately witness and all that kind of stuff. So it was deflating going back to Rikers Island. You know, it always felt deflating for me.
And do you remember how long the jury deliberated?
Yes, they deliberated for a few hours. I can tell you that for sure. So I believe they got the case in the afternoon. I'm going to say about 1, maybe 1:30, and about 4:30, 5 o'clock, they had a verdict.
With it being a co-trial, I guess, I'm not sure of legal terminology.
No, it was actually, they call those joint trials for here in New York State? Yes.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Was there one jury or was there two juries?
No, actually, a very good question, by the way. There was actually one jury, but prior to that, my lawyers were trying to make it so we can get separate juries into the courtroom, because our lawyer's position was that there was no way that we were going to, any reasonable juror was going to be able to make a fair assessment just based on the confessions that were made, because, you know, the confessions were identical in nature. The only difference was he was implicating me and I was implicating him. So our attorneys felt like there was no way that any juror looking at the evidence and looking at these confessions was going to be able to separate the two.
How did the jury decide on both accounts?
Well, they basically found us guilty of a murder in the second degree, felony murder, kidnapping, robbery in the second degree, and criminal possession of a weapon.
Both of you had the same charge?
Yes, that's correct.
And so what was the sentence?
We were both sentenced to 25 years to life.
And did you go back to Rikers?
Yes, I went back to Rikers Island for about 3 weeks, and on November 17th, I was sentenced. Prior to my sentence, I was, of course, ushered upstate to a place called Elmira Correctional Facility, which at that time was a reception center for inmates.
And what was prison like?
Oh, it was miserable for me. For me, early on, I have to be very, very honest about this. I believe I was in such a state of shock that I was so numb to what happened. It didn't register to me for quite a while, to be honest with you. Just getting over the fact that I had just been convicted of a crime I didn't commit, and I was sentenced to 25 years of life. And even prior to that, after that, coming upstate on this long bus ride from New York City all the way upstate near the Canadian border, to me, that was really, really tough, because all I can remember was this bus just kept going. It didn't stop. It just kept going. And I was saying to myself, oh, my God, I'm really, really far from home and don't know what's going to happen, if I'm ever going to get out and all that kind of stuff. But at the same time, it was one of those feelings where I just became numb after this particular bus ride. So when I actually got to the prison, you go through all the prison motions, all the prison stuff, and you get all the intake stuff they do at these prisons, and particularly at these reception centers. And it was just kind of just numb after that, so.
And being so far away, how did that affect your relationship with your family?
Oh, it was huge early on, because I know for me, first of all, my mom was like 8.5, maybe 10 hours away from New York City where I lived, my family lived. And there was no way I was going to let them ask them to come up to Elmira, because it was, first of all, it was too far. And number two, Elmira is at least the part I was in is part reception center. So there's a good chance that I wasn't going to be at this place for very long. So that being said, I wanted to sort of wait and see where I will end up next before I get in contact with my family and have them come visit me and that sort of thing.
Did you get moved again?
Yeah, I got moved. I got moved to a place called Coxsackie Correctional Facility. It's near Albany. It's like 45 minutes from Albany, the capital of New York. And, Coxsackie at the time was predominantly a jail for adolescents like myself and Willie. So we were both taken there to Coxsackie, and I stayed there for about 13 months. And after that time, I went to a place called Eastern Correctional Facility, where I stayed for 18 years.
What was the environment like? How did it differ in each different facility that you were in?
Well, Elmira was one of those situations where we were pretty much locked in the entire day, maybe, say, for an hour, where you can maybe go out, stretch, and make recreation, maybe take a shower, depending on what you wanted to do, but maybe a phone call, whatever the case may have been. Coxsackie was also a little bit differently, where the prison, you were given, ironically, a little bit more freedom, so to speak. You were able to sort of move around, you can go to the yard, and that sort of thing. But one thing about Coxsackie was almost like a microcosm of Rikers Island. And I'm not a stereotyping here when I say this, only because it was a lot of young people in this particular prison. And one had to be very, very careful, because there was a lot of stuff going on. And you had to be very careful about that. So I learned that early on when I was on Rikers Island. So, Coxsackie was one of those places where, the prison guards treated young people accordingly, I guess,
Because you were a young person, did they offer you educational services? Were you able to finish your education?
Oh, yes. Yeah. So when I was in Coxsackie, my biggest reward, I guess, if that makes any sense, in that prison, was the fact that I acquired my GED there. Took a lot of vocational programs and classes too. But to be honest about the vocational classes, I wasn't really that much focused on that. I was more focused on getting my GED, because I wanted to complete that.
I'm talking to you now. So obviously some kind of process led to your release. So you said the longest place you were at for 18 years. Is that right?
That's correct, yes.
So what led to the process of you being released?
Wow. My state and federal appeals were exhausted in 1989. So once your state and federal appeals are exhausted, you're pretty much left to fend for yourself, meaning that there's no automatic appeals available to you. There's nothing. So what one is really left to do is try to look for some newly discovered evidence via investigations, hiring an investigator to investigate the case, maybe interview witnesses, or whatever the case may be. But that's almost like taking a shot in the dark, basically. So once I understood that my state and federal appeals were exhausted and was virtually nowhere else to go, what I decided to do is start a letter writing campaign. And during this letter writing campaign, I wrote to everyone who I thought would listen to me. For example, I wrote to the New York Daily News, the New York Post, the New York Times, Channel 7 Eyewitness News. I mean, I wrote to the politicians, basically. I mean, I wrote to law firms. I was all over the place. And I saved about 600 letters because I sometimes wrote people 1, 2, 3, or 4 times because, you know, in my mind, I wasn't going to take no for an answer because I knew at that particular time that my life was pretty much hanging in a balance. So I was desperate. I became desperate to find help. So one day while I was at Eastern Correctional Facility, I was working in the prison law library as a law clerk. So I had a friend by the name of Earl Coleman, another fellow inmate, who was actually reading this magazine called The Sun. And in this magazine, because I was really bored that night, I didn't have anything to do. I had finished my work and all that stuff. I was just waiting to go back to my housing unit. So I said to Earl, let me look at this magazine for a second. I just want to peruse it. And I had no intention of reading the magazine or anything like that. So during me looking at this magazine, what happened was I came across an article. I came across an article with a person by the name of Ken Klonsky, and he was interviewing Reuben Hurricane Carter. I knew who Reuben Hurricane Carter was. I knew he was a former prize fighter. That I definitely knew. And I also knew that he was wrongfully convicted. He was convicted for a triple homicide in Paterson, New Jersey. So what I decided to do is, because I read this article and I was looking for help, I wrote the Sun magazine asking for information about Reuben Hurricane Carter and the gentleman who was interviewing him. The magazine rolling back let me know, look, they couldn't give out personal information if they contacted the parties first. So I wrote them back and I said, okay, fine, if you can do that, I'd really appreciate it. If not, I thank you very much anyway. So he sent the letter, the Sun magazine sent my letter to Ken Klonsky, and about maybe a week and a half later, Mr. Klonsky wrote me back. During his correspondence, he promised me that he would only introduce me to Reuben through my particular letter to him, and that he couldn't promise anything after that. And that was fine. So at some point, you know, Reuben got my letter and read it and all that stuff, and he wrote me back, and we had a conversation, and we developed a relationship over time. And at that time, Reuben decided to look into my case. But before he did so, he wanted to know who I was. He wanted to know what I was doing with my time while I was in prison. I explained to him what I was doing, all the stuff that I had done. And then we started talking about my particular case.
Reuben Carter, you know, was taking an interest in your case. Like, I can't imagine how amazing that must have felt.
Oh, most definitely I was amazed, very much so. I mean, I was looking for an opportunity, and it came. And it happened by chance, because I often tell myself, even now, and when I do public speaking engagements, I say the same thing, that I could have easily went back to my cell that night, not looking at this magazine or doing nothing like that as such, and I would have never put myself in this position. So Reuben was founder of an organization called Innocence International, and they took on my case, and they looked at the case, they investigated the case for several years, and we also had an attorney by the name of Oscar Michelin, who took on the case pro bono, and, they investigated the case, they came to visit me, and we talked about the case. It was a really good relationship, but as always, in these kind of situations, which I've learned later on, that these cases are time-consuming. These investigations don't happen overnight. Before the previous DA took over as Charles Hines, we were getting a lot of pushback from him. In other words, he was claiming that he was investigating the case thoroughly, but he never did. So when a new Brooklyn District Attorney took over, Ken Toffman, God bless him, took over the case, he developed a new unit called the Conviction Review Unit. But Mr. Thompson himself, what I decided to do when I learned that he was running for DA is I decided to follow him through his campaign as much as I could. You know, I can still recall now staying up late at night, all of, 2 or 3, 4 o'clock in the morning, listening to campaign news. And I understood Mr. Thompson made some campaign promises that he would investigate wrongful convictions fairly and thoroughly. And at the time, I'm saying to myself, well, that's all we ever asked myself and my legal team. And, Mr. Carter, who unfortunately was died from cancer, on his deathbed, wrote a letter to Mr. Thompson asking him to look at my case. And Mr. Thompson looked at my case, and 10 months later, I was exonerated.
How did that feel? you know, you had been incarcerated for your entire adult life. How did it feel to be a free adult?
Oh, it was emotional for a lot of different reasons. I know I can recall being inside Brooklyn Supreme Court, getting on the elevator, getting ready to go upstairs to the courtroom, and I got on the elevator with Willie Stuckey's mom. I hadn't seen her in a very long time. And when I saw her, we hugged naturally. And what happened was she just broke down. You know, she said, it's supposed to be two of you. And I understood exactly what she meant when she said that. In other words, she felt like her son should be there too. But he wasn't. So we went inside the courtroom, and the judge, they went over the case and why, you know, they're dismissing the charges and that sort of thing. And so I embraced Willie's mom at the very end of the court proceeding, and she said, you're my son now. And for me, I just almost lost it there because it was such an emotional thing to just hear her say that. I mean, there was no animosity towards either of us because, you know, number, first of all, I didn't do anything wrong. And number two, I really, you know, particularly after learning that he had passed away while I was in prison, I vowed to continue to fight on.
How did he pass?
We don't know other than what the district attorney's office said to us, that it was a heart attack. We're not exactly sure if that's actually accurate or not, but that's what we were told.
What are you doing now?
Oh, wow. Okay. So now I work for the Manhattan Legal Aid Society. So I work with the support staff system there. Support staff. I'm a support staff member. I do a lot of data entry work. I do a lot of paperwork for the organization. So I definitely enjoy what I do. I think it's extremely meaningful. You know, I work with attorneys and social workers and those sorts of people like that because, you know, our office is broken down into different components. We have lawyers and social workers and, you know, paralegals and staff members, that sort of thing. So I'm very happy with what I'm doing right now, and I plan to do it for the foreseeable future.
And so how do you think that your experience has changed the way that you look at life? Do you think you're the same person?
No, actually, for me, I think, I don't take things for granted. When I was incarcerated, sometimes what inmates would do is we would go on medical trips to different facilities or hospitals, whatever the case may be. And during that bus ride, I noticed sometimes a lot of inmates would go to sleep in the morning because they had to get up early in the morning to go to these places. Me, I would just kind of stay up and look out the window, and I would look at, you know, people just kind of driving their cars or walking down the street or going inside of a store or whatever, or stopping at a gas station or something. I would just look at these things, you know, because for me, that represented something. That represented life. And so at that time, I said to myself, you know, if I ever got the opportunity to get out of prison, I'm not going to take anything for granted. You know, whether it be walking down the street or whatever the case may be, I'm not going to take anything for granted. And to this very day, I don't. I make sure that I cherish every step I take because I know how important it is and also understand that it can be my very last. So for me, I just don't take anything. I don't live my life in a vacuum either. You know, I don't micromanage my life, but at the same time, I don't take much for granted, though.
What advice do you have for someone who might have found themselves being wrongly accused?
Well, there's so much there. Thanks for the question. Number one, if they're in a situation like mine, particularly if they're young people, or if they're people that have no real clue about law enforcement, about the law, and about their legal rights, I would ask them if they ever taken out, I would advise them if they ever taken out to the precinct, anything like that. Whatever you do, under any circumstances, it's kind of easy for me to say this now because I didn't follow. And I would just simply say, look, you know, ask for an attorney, right? Because that's what they're there for. That's the right that we have. That's a constitutional right that we have to have an attorney present during any sort of questioning. Once that's mentioned, that's it. Two is after, you know, while they're in prison or in jail for that matter, rather than get distracted by some of the things that go on in prisons or in jails, focus on your case, right? Do some reading. Go to the law library. You know, do something constructive. Do constructive things with your time, because I can tell you, and I will tell them, that there are so many distractions in prison. But people would not believe how many distractions there are. And so I would ask them to just kind of focus on themselves and just try.
I've been told that a lot of people who are in prison get by without being in trouble by having a routine, like work and then go to the library and then maybe exercise, and keeping this routine in mind helps them to keep their mental strength.
That's exactly right. And I think that's one of the things that really made me a model. I was considered what they call a model prisoner. I mean, I had an extremely, extremely good institutional record. So and what really, really helped me is I had a routine, you know. But one of the dangers of having a routine in prison is you can become too comfortable, if that makes any sense. So you always have to be very, very conscious and careful about that.
This is the question that I get more than any other question. I've had about 1.5 million people listen to this show, and I get hundreds of emails of people asking what can they do to help people who have been wrongly convicted or people from becoming wrongly convicted. What do you think people like me, people who aren't attorneys, can do to help people?
Oh, sure, of course. So one of the things that I didn't have the luxury of having when I was incarcerated was access to social media, right? I mean, we had computers inside prisons, or at least the prisons where I was, but these computers were very, 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 very limited. And what I would suggest people do is go on social media and talk more about wrongful convictions. You know, it's extremely important. This is a universal problem. This is not just a New York State problem. This is a universal problem, right? And so as a result, why not? I mean, this can happen to anyone at any time, and it usually does. You know, we in Brooklyn just lost a district attorney here, and Ken Thompson. Yes, very much so. I had the pleasure of meeting him on a personal level after he released me, you know? And I have to say that although he set a very, very high bar as far as the review unit that he implemented, there's much more society and the public can do in this regard. You know, be more aware, and you can start a campaign, whether it be through social media or just everyday conversation at your work job, at your workspace, at the water coolers, wherever. Keep the conversation going because this is a pro. There's many, many people right now languishing in prison right now because they didn't catch the break that I caught. You know, they didn't get the kind of resource, they didn't have the resources that I had. So I was fortunate in that way. So for me, you know, from a personal standpoint, I'm paying it forward in that particular way too. So this it's not hard. Look, people have their lives to live, obviously, but and I understand that. There's also ways that you can help just by talking about it, right? Because sometimes we think we live in a society now is we what I call a moment society. When something happens on the spur of the moment, we talk about it for a little while, but then then it goes away until something else happens again. In this particular situation, unfortunately, wrongful convictions are not going away anytime soon. So why not continue this discussion? And that's all I would ask people to do. Just keep an open mind about this because it can happen to you. It can happen to anyone, and it usually does.
Did you have anything else that you wanted to say that we didn't talk about?
Oh, sure, of course, definitely. And I don't mean to say it simply because I'm talking to you. I want to thank you personally, all right? Because I think this kind of work is the kind of work that I just finished talking about that have to be done. It have to be talked about. It have to be discussed because, you know, I think sometimes in society we kind of take many, many things for granted, right? So when we see some person who spent, let's say, for example, myself, spent 29 years in prison and get out, and if, you know, people voice their opinions and concerns, and there's some really genuine concerns out there about these particular wrongful convictions. But it's forums like yours and many others who keep the dialogue going. And this is very, very important. I had the privilege on two occasions of going to Orlando, Florida, to the they have what we call the Innocence Network Conference there every year. So every year they have it in different states. So last year was in Orlando, this year was in San Antonio, and next year it's going to be in San Diego.
I'm hoping to go to that.
Oh, I hope you do. You will definitely see me there for sure.
That would be amazing.
Yeah, it would be. And, you know, so at these conferences, you're able to meet people across the country, really, right? But not only that, I also have the privilege of meeting people outside of the country who come to these forums. And it's there where you see and you get to have these kind of dialogues with people who experience very similar things that you experience, that I experience. And so when you get together with these groups of people for this particular cause, it's something to be said. And it's amazing how it grows every year. It's both good and bad because it's good in the fact that people are getting out of prison for things crimes they didn't commit, but it's bad and because there are so many of us. And where does it stop? And where does the conversation continue to, you know, to be had? And at these conferences, it's extremely important. There's so much, you know, so much to do.
Right. And I have to tell you, I was smiling when you said before that you have to keep the conversation going. And the Twitter minute is, like 15 minutes, and then the news has changed. And I just wanted to let you know, I'm not going anywhere. I'm going to keep telling people's stories.
I don't have any doubt about that. And, I do these interviews because it's important. I made a promise to myself that if I ever got out of prison, I am going to make sure that I do whatever I can or whatever I could to keep this going, to keep the conversation going. Because I know if not for the help of other people, I definitely would not be here talking to you under this particular situation.
I love to learn. I mean, that's how I got started with Actual Innocence in the first place. And now, with the Great Courses Plus, I can learn about any topic that I would like. And I can also learn new skills and expand my hobbies. With unlimited access to 7,000 engaging video lectures, I can learn how to cook, take better pictures, speak another language, and from anywhere, from any device. I'm still watching the lectures in the course called Forensic History, Crimes, Frauds, and Scandals. I cannot highly recommend this course enough. It fits in with so many of the topics covered on Actual Innocence. And, luckily, right now, as one of my listeners, you can sign up for the Great Courses Plus and get a free month of unlimited access to all of their lectures. So, sign up to get your free trial of the Great Courses Plus by going to thegreatcoursesplus.com/actual. Remember, that's the greatcoursesplus.com/actual. Thanks for joining me for this episode of Actual Innocence. Next week will be a very special Helpers episode, and I'm really excited to bring it to you. Keep in touch on social media, and remember, if you want to attend one of the meetups, go to the website and register. Now, here's Stephanie with the credits and a reminder on how to register for the upcoming events.
This episode of Actual Innocence was hosted and produced by Brooke Giddings. The Actual Innocence volunteer team is Stephanie Satilli, Sarah Nelson, Megan Delaney, and production assistants from Matt Ryan. Our executive producer is Dennis Robinson. You can find us on Twitter at ActualInPod. That's Actual INPOD. Or email us at actualinnocencepod@gmail.com. Visit our website, www.actualinpod.com, and click on the Support Us link at the top of the page to register for the upcoming meetups. Our logo was designed by Vale Darris, and the Actual Innocence rap was composed by Rapper Man, both of which you can find on Fiverr.com. That's Fiverr.com. Our theme song was composed by Matt Cullen. Special thanks to our sponsors, ABC and the show Conviction, and The Great Courses Plus. And also a special thank you to our guest, David McCallum.